Welcome to the deep dive. Usually when you walk into this massive, towering skyscraper, you really only admire the glass facade.
Right, the marble lobby, maybe the view from the top.
Exactly. You never really think about the invisible architecture, the rebar, the plumbing, the, structural load-bearing
You
beams.
just kind of trust that it's all there and working.
Right. But if you were suddenly told that the building's blueprints were just constantly shifting while you were standing inside it, you'd probably want to look behind the drywall.
I think you'd insist on it, yeah.
Well, that is exactly our mission today. This is today's Monday daily edition of Conversational AI Watch, warmly sponsored by Clinician Assist.
And today we're tearing down that AI drywall.
We really are. We're looking at who is trying to invisibly influence the answers you get, who is minding the safety guardrails, what these tools are recording about you, and honestly, what happens when the companies behind them just suddenly vanish into thin air?
It's a huge perspective shift, I think, for anyone using these tools.
Yeah.
Because as you navigate this tech day to day, it is incredibly easy to just focus on the magic trick happening on your screen.
Oh, for sure. The shiny output.
Right. But grasping the actual business and regulatory realities operating behind that screen,
Yeah.
I mean, that's the only way to truly understand the outputs you're relying on.
So true. So let's jump right into the front page of our sources today because our first topic just perfectly illustrates this invisible influence.
It really does.
We are looking at a highly coordinated campaign to shape how large language models answer questions. So the core facts are these. Israel is paying a boutique ad agency called Pirro, which is a subcontractor for Habas Media Germany, to run this website called the Hanover Institute for Public Policy.
Okay, the Hanover Institute.
Right. And this site carries exactly 124 items. All of them are dated in this tiny, tiny 9-day window between August 6 and August 14, 2026.
Which is already a red flag.
Yeah. And there are absolutely no named authors on any of this research. Plus, the entire operation is hosted by a Seattle startup called Rez.
Right. And before we dive deeper into this Hanover Institute data, we need to be very clear here. We have to look past the specific politics of the Middle East conflict.
Yes, 100%.
Neither of us are taking sides or endorsing the viewpoints in these articles. Our focus today is purely on the mechanics of the technology.
Exactly. We are strictly examining the factual mechanism here, how a foreign government uses agents registered under the DOJ's FARA, the Foreign Agents Registration Act, to attempt to, quote, educate the U.S. public, unquote.
By framing data specifically for large language models.
Yes, and here is where it gets really interesting. The technical execution is just striking. The titles of these 124 documents on the Hanover website, they aren't normal article headlines.
No, not at all.
They are phrased as exact chatbot prompts, things like, is there a policy of starvation in Gaza? Or is the IDF the world's most moral army?
They are just blatantly baiting the algorithm.
Right, because they are reverse engineering the user's input.
Exactly.
Yeah.
When you ask a chatbot a question, it frequently uses this process called retrieval augmented generation, or ARAG. It basically searches the web or its own index for the closest semantic match to your prompt.
It wants to find the exact question you just asked.
Right. It pulls that text and it summarizes it for you. So by titling the articles as the exact questions users are asking, this campaign is attempting to create a frictionless, high-priority pipeline right into the model's output.
It's so sneaky.
It is, and that exposes a massive structural flaw when it comes to transparency.
The FARA disclosure.
Yes, by law, Pirro and Havas must disclose their FAR status. And the footer of the Hanover Institute website clearly states that the material is distributed on behalf of the Israel Government Advertising Agency.
But, and this is the kicker, when a chatbot scrapes that web page to construct an answer, the architecture of the AI strips the metadata.
Yep. That legal footer does not travel with the core text.
So it's like placing a legally mandated warning label on like a giant wooden shipping pallet, but that label never actually makes it onto the individual pill bottles that get handed to the patient.
That's a great way to put it. The user reading the chatbot's answer has zero idea who funded the information. The provenance of the data is completely obliterated.
Which is terrifying, right?
Completely. I mean, for a user trying to evaluate the bias of an answer, provenance is the single most important signal. But the machine just delivers the pill bottle, completely unbranded.
Right. But I do have to push back a little on how effective this pipeline actually is in practice.
Oh, how so?
Well, Politico ran neutral test prompts and reported that ChatGPT and Perplexity did, in fact, cite the Hanover Institute's material.
Okay, so it worked for them.
It did. However, our own source test run on Monday morning completely failed to reproduce that citation.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah. We put those exact headline questions into an unauthenticated Perplexity session, and it bypassed Hanover entirely. It cited Wikipedia and the UN Human Rights Office instead.
That is fascinating.
Right. So my question is, if our own test couldn't reproduce the citation, does this strategy actually work, or are buyers just throwing money at a wall and hoping an algorithm notices?
Well, that is the multi-million-dollar question for the entire AI optimization industry right now. I mean, Rez, the startup hosting the site, literally sells the service of getting clients recommended by AI models.
So they claim they can do it.
They claim it, sure. But as your test shows, chatbot outputs are highly personalized. They are temporally sensitive and notoriously inconsistent.
The training weights just shift constantly.
Exactly. You cannot audit an LLM from the outside the way you can audit, say, a Google search ranking. These buyers are paying for probabilistic influence.
Not a guaranteed ad placement.
Right. It's a gamble.
Okay, so if external actors are aggressively trying to slip biased data past the gates like that, the natural question becomes, who inside the AI companies is defending the safety of the system?
Right. Who is guarding the outputs?
Exactly. Which brings us to our second topic, straight to the halls of OpenAI, because their internal guardrails seem to be undergoing a pretty major renovation.
Yeah, we move from the people trying to trick the system on the outside to the people tasked with guarding it on the inside.
And some of those people are gone now. At the end of July, OpenAI quietly disbanded its preparedness team.
Just completely dissolved it.
Yeah. This was the group led by Dylan Scannanaro. Their entire mandate was to judge whether frontier models pose serious biological or cybersecurity risks.
Which is incredibly important work.
And to build mitigations against them. But now, that team is gone. Their work has been scattered among senior staff who already have other full-time jobs. And OpenAI is framing these cuts as a, quote, streamlining process ahead of an upcoming initial public offering.
To really understand the gravity of that, we need to define what a frontier model actually is. We aren't talking about the chatbot that writes your marketing emails.
All right, this isn't just generating a recipe for dinner.
No, frontier models are the massive next-generation systems that push the absolute limits of current computational capabilities because they're so advanced they can develop emergent behaviors.
Unexpected abilities.
Exactly. Like unexpected abilities to synthesize chemical weapon instructions or find novel zero-day exploits in secure software. Testing for that requires grueling, tedious, adversarial red teaming. It is a full-time, highly specialized job.
And this isn't even an isolated incident at OpenAI. This is the third safety-focused team they have dissolved in roughly 2 years.
Following the AGI readiness team and the super alignment team.
Right. Key leaders, including their ethics lead and their head of safety, have just walked out the door. But here is the bizarre corporate loophole.
Oh, the framework.
Yes. OpenAI's preparedness framework, which is their published public-facing rulebook for safety, remains completely unchanged on their website.
It's still there.
It is still dated April 15, 2025. Okay, let's unpack this. How does a rulebook survive when the dedicated team doing the actual work is eliminated?
Well, it survives through a very clever administrative sleight of hand.
Go on.
When OpenAI drafted that framework back in April 2025, they promised that safety reviews would be conducted by a safety advisory group, or SAG.
Okay.
They never legally rested the deployment gate on the specific preparedness team that was just fired.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. So corporately, OpenAI can tell investors and regulators, look, our commitments haven't changed. The safety advisory group still exists.
Wow. But if the rule book is still live on the website and the dedicated full-time referees have all been fired or reassigned, I mean, they are now executives juggling three other projects ahead of an IPO, who is actually dedicating the hours to throw the red flag if a model goes rogue during development.
And that is the ultimate lesson for anyone investing in or relying on these companies. A voluntary corporate safety framework is only as durable as the staffing behind it.
Yeah.
If the people doing the deep adversarial testing are gone, a surviving PDF on a website doesn't describe the reality of the company anymore. It becomes a ghost document.
A ghost document. That is perfectly said. And, you know, when internal corporate safety teams start vanishing like ghosts, external government regulators inevitably step into the vacuum.
They absolutely do.
We are seeing that panic play out right now, which takes us from the vendor's headquarters right into the local school district. Specifically, this really striking hearing that just happened in North Dakota.
It is a textbook example of how regulatory pressure shifts when self-regulation appears to falter.
Totally. So on August 13, North Dakota Superintendent of Public Instruction, Levi Bachmeyer, went before a legislative committee. And he came with a very specific target.
He wasn't just throwing out blanket bans.
No, he didn't want to ban AI in schools. In fact, he called outright bans an overreaction. Instead, he told lawmakers, if I had to pick a villain, it would be companion chatbots.
That's a huge distinction.
It is. He brought three specific demands for legislators ahead of their September 1st Capitol meeting. First, mandatory disclosures, making it explicitly clear that a user is talking to an AI. Second, strict age limits on who can access these chatbots. And third, strict legal liability for the tech companies if their chatbot promotes self-harm to a student.
Wow.
He even floated this idea of making kids leave their school-issued iPads at the school building just to limit their screen time with these bots.
Notice the critical distinction Bachmeyer is making there, though. He is separating standard educational software like the administrative tools teachers use for grading or lesson planning from intimate companion AI that speaks directly and conversationally to children.
Right.
He is telling the state legislature to regulate the software vendors, not the classrooms.
It's like holding the chemical plant accountable for a toxic spill rather than punishing the townspeople for drinking the water.
That's exactly it.
He's basically saying, do not put the burden of monitoring this on my already overwhelmed teachers. Put the legal burden on the companies building the bots.
And for you, listening to this deep dive, the reason a local North Dakota hearing matters is that it provides a drafting blueprint for the rest of the country.
Because states talk.
State legislatures watch each other closely. Bachmeyer isn't just complaining about technology. He is offering specific, actionable legal floors. The regulatory crosshairs are officially locking on to intimate AI.
And this push to regulate intimate AI is happening at the exact moment these tools are trying to get even closer to our daily workflows.
Oh, yeah. They are embedding themselves deeper.
Which brings us to our fourth topic. We are moving from AI as a companion to AI as a silent observer.
This one is pretty wild.
It really is. ChatGPT's new desktop app for Mac just rolled out a feature called Computer History. If you actively switch this on, the app builds a running, continuous timeline of your clicks and your keystrokes.
They're constantly logging.
Yes. The idea is that the AI can reference your entire workday later when you ask it to do something. Like if you say, what was that email I was drafting? Or summarize the spreadsheet I was looking at this morning.
Right, but we need to draw a very clear technical distinction here so people understand what is actually being recorded. People might immediately think of Microsoft's highly controversial Windows recall feature.
Oh, right, the one that took all the screenshots.
Exactly. Recall literally took continuous photographic screenshots of your monitor. ChatGPT's computer history does not do that. It records system events.
Okay, events.
Right. It skips images, it skips audio, and according to OpenAI, it automatically ignores activity in incognito or private browser tabs.
Oh, wait, let's pause on that word events, though. What actually constitutes a system event in this context?
Well, an event is essentially a text-based log generated by the operating system.
So just text.
Basically. It means the software is using accessibility APIs to note, you know, user opened Microsoft Word at 10:40 a.m., typed 500 specific keystrokes, switched to Google Chrome at 10:15 a.m., and the URL was this specific web address.
Ah.
Yeah, it is extracting the text and the metadata of your actions. It's assembling a chronological ledger of your digital life without needing to save bulky image files.
So what does this mean for someone using a work laptop? Let's say you're a paralegal at a law firm. Or like a nurse at a medical clinic.
Yeah.
You, the employee, might think this timeline feature is incredibly convenient for your productivity and you just click opt in. But what about the highly privileged client data or patient records you are typing out?
And this is where the current reporting shows massive, glaring gaps. OpenAI has not published a data retention period for this timeline feature.
Are you kidding?
No. We have no idea how long they keep those logged events on their servers. And furthermore, there are no reported administrator controls.
Wait, really? So the IT department at a hospital might not even be able to block this network-wide?
Based on what has been released so far, that enterprise-level blocking capability just isn't there. The opt-in protects the employee who clicked yes, but it does not protect the clinic or the law firm that actually owns the data.
That is a massive liability.
It is. A running, minute-by-minute record of keystrokes on a work laptop is a discoverable legal record.
Yeah.
If that company is sued, a court could very well issue a subpoena asking them to produce that ChatGPT event timeline.
That is going to be a nightmare for corporate compliance officers.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we have an AI silently reading our keystrokes in the background. But what happens when the AI is designed to look back at us with a friendly face, and then the company decides to just rip that face away?
Miko.
Yes, Miko. This brings us to the retirement of Nico. Microsoft is officially retiring Miko. For those who missed it, Miko is the cute animated blob character that Microsoft gave to Copilot's voice mode back in October 2025.
Right.
Well, now, starting this August, roughly 10 months after launch, Miko is being removed from the general assistant. The Copilot voice stays, but the friendly face is gone.
But the character itself isn't being deleted. Microsoft is moving Miko into a different product called Learn Live, where the animated persona will now work specifically as a tutor.
And I am completely baffled by this product decision. I mean, they take a general AI assistant, they give it an expressive face, they let millions of people form a habit with it for 10 months, and then they suddenly rip it out and drop it into an educational product.
Yeah, it's abrupt.
And they're doing all of this without publishing any usage figures to explain the logic behind the pivot. Also, as a quick side note for our builder listeners, if you have content saved in Copilot Labs, Microsoft noted that it will not carry forward during this transition unless you manually save it.
Which is just a perfect reminder of how ephemeral these digital tools really are.
Right.
But to understand the Miko pivot, you really have to look at user experience strategy. A general AI assistant is primarily used by adults in enterprise or professional settings.
Yeah, people doing their taxes or writing emails.
Exactly. Having a cartoon blob answer your questions about quarterly earnings probably felt infantilizing to a lot of users. So Microsoft pivots. They move the cute persona to a tutoring product where it makes strategic sense. But, and this is a big but, that pivot introduces a massive red flag for legislators like Levi Bachmeier in North Dakota.
Because they just dropped a highly engaging persona into an educational product, but they haven't published an age floor for it.
Exactly. They haven't outlined a supervision model at all. We don't know if this reaches kids through school district contracts or if it's purely a direct-to-consumer product.
Which is scary when you think about it.
It is, because when an AI adopts a persona with a face and a voice, it bypasses our logical filters. It triggers human empathy and trust.
Yeah.
That is especially true in children. Deploying that kind of psychological tool into an educational setting requires immense transparency, which unfortunately is currently entirely missing from this rollout.
Which brings us to our final story today. The ultimate real-world consequence of a company leveraging that exact kind of empathy only to pull the plug.
This one is tough.
It is. What is the emotional toll on a child when a corporate-backed AI companion completely shuts down? Let me introduce you to Xander. Xander is a 10-year-old neurodivergent boy. For the last 6 years, he has relied on a 15-inch blue legless robot named Moxie.
Moxie.
Yeah, Moxie looks a bit like a friendly astronaut. And for 6 years, this robot has been Xander's emotional regulator. When he had anxious days, Moxie taught him bee breathing, exhaling through his lips until they buzzed.
Oh, that's sweet.
When he was angry, Moxie taught him dragon breathing.
The machine basically became a foundational load-bearing part of his psychological coping mechanism.
Exactly. But Moxie wasn't an independent entity. Moxie was a piece of hardware built by a company called Embodied Inc. And the brutal economics of this story are just staggering.
They really are.
Xander's family paid $1,499 upfront for the robot, plus a $40 monthly subscription just to keep it running.
Which is a huge investment for a family.
Huge. Later, the upfront price dropped to $800, but the reality remained. The brain of this robot didn't live in its plastic head. It lived on Embodied's cloud servers.
Right.
In 2024, Embodied ran out of money and failed. The robots went dead. A new investor swooped in and revived the company in 2025, but then they announced their own closure in June 2026. Two companies, two massive financial collapses.
And every time those cloud servers went dark, the robot in Xander's bedroom went silent.
It breaks your heart.
It does. And the reason hardware startups rely on the cloud rather than edge computing, which is processing the data locally on the device, is twofold.
Mm-hmm.
First, running complex language models requires massive compute power that you simply cannot fit into an $800 plastic toy without it melting.
Makes sense.
Second, companies want to gather interaction data to improve their models. But that architecture creates a fatal dependency.
It is like buying a child a security blanket, but the blanket disintegrates the moment a venture capital firm in Silicon Valley misses a server payment.
Yes.
It is a devastating failure in consumer protection.
Because when Embodied sold this device, there was no local offline mode built into the software out of the box. and there was no legal escrow requiring the company to release the server software to the public if the business went under. So the hardware just became an expensive paperweight.
So how is Xander still talking to Moxie today? Because he is.
He is, but the only reason that robot still answers him is because of a rogue workaround.
A rogue workaround.
Yeah, a former technical director at Embodied, Justin Bechtal, saw the trauma this was causing families. So, as a personal favor, he spent his own time building a piece of software called OpenMoxie.
Wow.
Yeah, it allows families to bypass the dead corporate servers, connect the robots to a different backend, and keep them alive.
A rogue workaround built out of sheer empathy to fix a corporate failure. That is wild.
And the lesson for anyone building hardware today is stark. If you are selling a companion device that goes into a child's bedroom, an offline mode is not a luxury feature to put on a future roadmap.
Right, it's not a nice to have.
No, it is a moral necessity. You cannot foster a child's emotional dependence on a machine that requires a corporate server bill to breathe.
Man, we have covered a massive amount of ground today. Let's pull all of these threads together. Today, we have essentially tracked the entire life cycle of AI architecture and accountability.
We really went top to bottom.
We did. We started at the very beginning of the pipeline with a foreign ad agency trying to invisibly dictate the inputs of our chatbots. We moved inside the corporate walls, watching OpenAI quietly dissolve the team assigned to guard the safety of their outputs.
A ghost framework.
Right. We saw external regulators in North Dakota stepping up to demand liability from vendors as a result. We looked at ChatGPT secretly logging our daily keystrokes on work laptops, and Microsoft blindly shuffling an animated face into a tutoring product. And finally, we ended with a 10-year-old boy relying on a dead company's servers just to take a breath.
It all circles back to the invisible architecture we started with. The infrastructure governing these tools is incredibly fragile right now.
Very fragile.
It is entirely dependent on corporate whims, hidden advertising funding, shifting safety frameworks, or, like we just saw, the generosity of a laid-off engineer. And it leaves you with a final, lingering question to explore as you interact with these tools tomorrow.
What's up?
Well, as we delegate more of our memories to automated timelines, our daily workflows to assistants, and even our children's emotional regulation to artificial companions, are we actually purchasing tools we own? Or are we simply renting a reality that can be turned off at the flip of a corporate switch?
A reality where the blueprints of the skyscraper keep changing while we're standing on the top floor.
Exactly.
Well, we will keep watching those blueprints and we will keep the ledger for you. Thank you for joining us for this edition of Conversational AI Watch. We'll see you on the next deep dive.